Good afternoon, good morning, I guess good evening, wherever you are. This is Susan King, and we're at Where Genealogy and Spirit Connect. We're coming to you with a whole new sound system, so if I seem a little bit off, it's because the way I'm hearing and things are just a little different than what I'm used to. In any event, today we're going to talk about something I think that needs to be discussed, because, you know, one of the things I was thinking about before today's show is, what would it be like if we were sitting at our desk in our office and twittering away as we do, or Facebooking and doing all these things we do today, and there's a knock on the door, and we go to the door, and the next thing we know, we're dragged out of our house. Our family, our friends are being dragged out of their houses, and we're put into these trucks, and we're hauled off to places we don't know where. And you know, it's an interesting thought, because this happened, and it happened back in during World War II, and people were dragged out of their homes. Some people were shot right on the spot, and they were taken off and put into cattle cars and shipped to concentration camps. And what's scary about this is, if you put yourself in the shoes of these people that lived just 60, 70 years before us, and you wonder what it would be like to have the same situation happen to you, I think that we might all better have a understanding of what it is like to, I guess, really focus on peace and to try to ensure that this kind of thing doesn't happen again. And the reason I bring this story up is because one of the things that I've been doing for most of my career over the last 27 years has been focusing on connecting and reconnecting families that were separated through the Holocaust. And, you know, now that the older generations are beginning to leave us, you know, it's really time that these stories and this situation, no matter what religion you are, whether you or what race you are, that we need to understand what really did happen 70 years ago, and we really need to make sure that this does not happen. So, one of the things that has come about in the last week, and my guest, who is actually a repeat guest, Justin Schroffer with Footnote.com, and we're here to talk about the new Holocaust collection that's really one of the first interactive databases on the subject that has come onto the internet these recent years. And really the purpose of it, I think, is mostly education and to make sure that we see what happened and we feel and we empathize and we work towards making sure it doesn't happen again. So Justin, welcome again.
Thank you for having us, Susan.
In any event, I was very excited, I think as many are, to see the effort and the work that has gone on with the partnership between Footnote.com and NARA and the United States Holocaust Museum on making sure that some of this information and these records are available to the public. And you want to talk a little bit about how all this came to be?
You know, it's an interesting story. We've been working with the National Archives for about almost 3 years in digitizing their content and putting it up on our site, and then also developing tools where people can enhance those documents and connect with each other. They came to us with, we worked with them regularly as to what content we need to put up on the site, and they came to us with some Holocaust assets records that they wanted to have digitized and indexed. And they said it was one of their more popular collections, and I think it really started to become very popular when there were those lawsuits that were happening in the 90s as it related to Jewish assets. And the popularity has continued to grow with this collection. As we looked at it, we thought this tells a very interesting story that maybe not a lot of people really know, but what else does the National Archives have that we could probably create, an entire Holocaust collection to really start to tell this story from a different perspective? And as we investigated their records, they had concentration camp records. They had captioned German files. They had, interrogation reports from the Nuremberg trials. So we basically worked together with them to put all of these records together into a collection, making them available on the Internet for the first time, and, again, putting our social tools around them in order to make these documents come to life and allow people to make contributions or tell their side of the story as well. And that's, in a nutshell, that's what has resulted in this Holocaust collection that we recently launched on footnote.com, and it's been very well received, and it's just exciting to see these stories now come out where people can access them or available.
And I understand this collection is available for free through the month of October.
Yes, during the month of October, all of these collections that we have will be available free to the public where they can view the original images. And if you just go to footnote.com/Holocaust, it'll take you to a microsite that actually will feature those documents as well as additional information that we have pulled together. For instance, we work together with the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. They had 600 of stories from victims and from survivors of the Holocaust, and they have those on their site, and we asked them as part of this collection, could we put those on our site as well where people could access them and put it into an interactive environment where people could add photos, add stories, additional stories or comments, any type of additional information. And they thought that was a great idea as well. So on this microsite, you'll find all of these stories as well that really do, from a first-hand account, give a perspective of the Holocaust that is it's disturbing, it's sobering, but at the same time, as you mentioned before, it gives us a greater appreciation. It helps us not to forget. And on the site, you are able to, in addition to the 600, if you happen to know any of those stories from maybe somebody that you knew, an ancestor, grandfather, great-grandfather, or mother, then those stories can be captured using Footnote, all, using the tools for free. And it's what you alluded to earlier. It's really the generations are passing away, and with that, the stories are disappearing. And we really wanted to put an effort to capture these stories by putting out documents that help tell the story, but also drawing people in to help them to capture, preserve those stories so that we really don't forget the details of what this event entailed.
You know, I spent many a day on the street corners in small towns in Eastern Europe, and it's pretty fascinating the stories that these people would tell, and these at the time were children who didn't really understand what was going on. And they watched their schoolmates and their neighbors be dragged out of their houses. And, it was amazing how we attracted when we went there in groups to study family history and our family histories. We would collect these crowds. And one of the most amazing stories was in my ancestral town. And we were standing on the corner, and one person came, and another person came, and our translator was describing the sights and the scenes as these people had remembered it, back in during the war. And this man came running out of his house, and his arms are flailing, and I'm panicking because I have no idea what's going on. And it turned out that his father had been a worker in the synagogue, which is where we're standing in front of the old synagogue, and he actually had a record player that was at the synagogue right before the, in simple terms, the Jews were dragged out of the town, and he wanted me to have it. And I tell you what, the tears streaming down these people's faces as they remember these stories. And it's frightening because, we're in the situation today where we don't know what's going to happen. And, there's so much anger in the world and so much fighting and so many things going on that it is so important that the younger generations and the interactiveness of this database is that, people can begin, I think, to immerse themselves into, you know, what did happen. And, you know, looking at some of the data, I mean, you know, Justin, I've been involved in you know, collecting Holocaust data for many, many, many years. And some of the data collections I've seen before in the index form, but I have not actually personally seen the actual records. And I know I went through the Dachau records the first day it was up, and it was chilling.
You know, it's one thing to talk about events and maybe have other people talk about it. When you see something tangible in front of you, that and it doesn't need to be much in order for it to really chill you or to touch you. I was looking through some of the similar records, those concentration camp records, and I found there are these entry lists, there are these death records, basically listing the names of the people that were in those camps. It's pretty ironic that for the Nazis, who were so dedicated to exterminating this group of people, they took meticulous records of who these people were, and which benefits us now to learn a little bit more. But on some of these records, it will have, you know, the names of the people. It'll have their birthplaces, their birth dates. Even sometimes it will include what possessions they had when they came into the concentration camps and so forth. But when I looked at a record, it was a simple record, a list of people. But to see that in front of you, and I have no ties to the Holocaust personally, but when you see that in front of you and you go through the list and you can see that there's a name of an elderly man, maybe 72 years, that was killed on this date, and then just a little bit further down the list, you see a boy that was 12 years old that was killed. And it really, just even that tells a story that no association can really be touched by it, you know, by seeing these original documents. And that's what we hope it really does for people, is it brings it more to a reality that this did happen, and there's details behind this that when you start to realize, it puts it in a really different perspective.
And I think today that's what we need to do is for those of us who had family that you know, and have been touched, you know, by the Holocaust. You know, for those that haven't, I think it's very important that these kind of documents be seen. And you know, I remember going back to the Holocaust Museum, United States Holocaust Museum, when it first opened, you know, many, many years ago now. And, you know, how touching and chilling it was to go through and see the artifacts. And, you know, now this can be done in some ways now with, you know, for school children and without having to make a trip to Washington, D.C. and is really, and to people in Europe and all over the world, so that, you know, those who can't afford to travel and those that, you know, or can't travel, that this information is now seen. You know, I was struck, by the quality of the penmanship on some of these records. I mean, I have never really seen such meticulous penmanship. I mean, it was almost so perfect in how these documents were written and kept, and more so than anything that I've seen in U.S. Census records. I mean, I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, they're fantastic records. And, you know, like kind of like what you said before is, you've seen some of these records, maybe just in index form, but really it's impressive to see the actual document itself, and it does add a different level to it. But they took very, very good records. Now, what makes it this even more useful is these records have been available at the National Archives for, you know, since the war, essentially, and, you know, been declassified and all sorts of things. But there was, with the Holocaust Assets Collection, the Ardelia Hall, there was a person from the National Archives, a researcher that went in and tried to create a finding aid so people would, you know, if they knew what they were looking for, would be able to locate some of the records at the National Archives. And this finding aid, over a number of years, had developed into 1,200 pages. It's a book that's 1,200 pages, and that's just the finding aid. And the real beauty of putting these online is the indexing of those documents, so that simply you can type in a name or browse to some information. But by doing that, it really does make it so people that can't travel or don't even have the kind of the research background that has been required to find things in these documents in the past, they can simply type in something. It does allow for more people to find information than they've ever been able to find before, and that's another huge benefit of being able to put these records online, the availability, but also the findability as well.
Now, you know, with a lot of your collections, you know, a lot of them are in various stages of completion. So, you know, what is the production stage of completion of all the indexing of all these records, or are they complete, or?
That's a great question. The when we first launched this, we launched with a couple hundred thousand images already. And with this kind of the records that we've identified with the Ardelia Hall and some mm-hmm. of the other records, it's about 1 million images of documents that we'll be digitizing here in the next little while and putting those up. But we've already got almost about 500,000 indexed and digitized already up on the site. And we're going to continue to add that. And I believe there was a National Archives representative that, you know, took an estimate that there was probably around 14 or 15 million documents at the National Archives associated with the Holocaust. And so we'll look into, you know, this first phase will amount to about 1 million records, and then we'll, you know, continue to look at the other collections and in addition putting other, you know, information on the site. But our hope is that as we put up information, that there's a lot of people that have information themselves, almost their own shoeboxes of letters and documents and photos that have been up in their closet. We're hoping that this will be a place where not only are we going to be putting up millions of documents, but that other people will come and start to share what they have, which aren't located in any archives or anywhere else other than in their own personal family histories. And we know we all have those. And it's a great means of being able to not only preserve them by digitizing, but also being able to share them, adding more pieces of the puzzle to where you can get a better picture of what was going on during that time.
And, you know, you bring that up, and let's talk a little bit about the social networking interactivity of the whole footnote site and what the whole capability is. Because I think that in a lot of situations, I don't think, you know, people really fully understand and grasp the broadness of the scope of what it is that, you know, footnote.com is really all about. And, you know, as a genealogist, of course, we talked about this when you were on the show, I think back in August, that, you know, you're really more of a historical site, but, you know, there's a lot of content that really is of great genealogical value. So let's talk a little bit about this whole social networking thing, because I think that the power of that is pretty incredible.
Yeah, we didn't want to just be an online archive of records where people just come and grab something and leave. We wanted this to be an area where people could come and share additional insights and information that they may have. In doing so, again, I use the analogy of adding pieces, you know, to the puzzle. Puzzle pieces to the picture, and it really having member contributions come into play is where people can really start to get help. There's nothing more intimidating than trying to do family history or any type of research and just feel like you're on your own. But coming to the site, we allow people to make these contributions, and everything is attributed to a specific user. So if I were to upload a photo, people would be able to see that it came from me. And then we've allowed for means on the site where people can get in touch with each other. So whether it be you know, a correction, like maybe I had my dates wrong on a document that I had uploaded, or a comment that I made, or just simply getting in touch saying, hey, this was my great-grandfather too. I have actually his letters that he wrote while he was serving in World War One. I thought you might be interested. Or any one of those type of connections can be made on Footnote by people contributing to each other. And again, that's really where we want to pull everybody's information together. Now, all of the social aspects to the site where you can upload your own content, you can annotate, basically get in touch with people, leave comments, create your own pages, all of that is a free service on our site. We wanted to make it completely open and allow people to come and do things with the content and with each other. And so that is a completely free aspect to the site. And the result of that is we do see these contributions being made, people that are adding additional information, a different side to the story, and it really does end up being very useful and people, you know, trying to get in touch with each other, and it can be just a very powerful tool in order to bring people together. I should mention that one thing that we just recently added, and I can't remember if we talked about this before in August, but these pages that are able to be created, or even these stories that I had alluded to before about the Holocaust, to bring everybody to Footnote, of course, is going to be a task that we'll be faced with for quite some time. But we thought, you know what, there is a place where people are engaging with each other, and a lot of people, where families are coming together already and friends, and that's Facebook. And so what we made possible is through an application on Facebook, we created an I Remember application for Facebook. That basically allows any pages that are created on Footnote to be shared on Facebook in the Facebook environment. So it really, if I had something about my great-grandfather, I could, with a click of a button, I can share that on Facebook, all the photos and stories that I've uploaded, in an environment that people are already used to and already accustomed to. And we're hoping that also pulls more people in as well. And contributions made on either side, whether it was a comment made on Facebook on that page or on Footnote or a photo uploaded, it shows up on both sides. And, you know, we talked with a lot of people, family historians especially, and a great frustration was nobody's really interested in this except for me. And we're hoping that by putting it into a format where people are already engaged, that this will open that up for more people to be interested in their histories and interested in, contributing or just, you know, simply reading some information. And we're excited about that Facebook application. We're hoping that will help people as well.
Those are tongue twisters, and I can't even say it. Facebook, but no.
Oh, I know. I guess, believe me, I've had plenty of practice.
Yep. Some of these words that we use today are for,
we never would have thought of using those a couple of years ago, that's for sure.
It really is. It really is amazing. And you know, I mean, I think that, drawing people in between, you know, the different social networks is also a very powerful tool. It really excites me because, it really allows for people to interact in different places, but, you know, to be able to share in one central source. Because, you know, as you say, I mean, I have probably, maybe 40, 50 of my family members that are on my Facebook page. And probably none of them are involved in my genealogy.
That's a typical scenario.
Now, they're interested in the end result, but they're not really interested in doing it. I do have some.
Well, I was going to say, it would surprise you that, by sharing it in that environment, those that are not interested in maybe doing hardcore research, it'd be surprising to people on how much they really do know or where maybe some location is located, about the family. Oh, yeah, I remember, my dad talking about that. In fact, I think he has that journal or something. So just even from a informal way, you can get your family involved in helping with that research, or at least pointing you in the right direction.
You know, and it's so very true. I mean, a lot of the client base that I have and cases that I'm working on for, doing research is, some people have copies of the family Bible and some have no clue where they ended up. And, that would be an interesting collection one day, is to try to, document these pages out of these family Bibles that ended up in one family and not in another.
Absolutely.
So there you go. There's another idea.
There we go. We'll get working on it.
Yep, it is amazing. And also, too, documents that have been translated, instead of people having to pay, to have it done and things are done over and over and over and over again, it'd be an interesting concept there, too.
Yep, I agree.
Yeah. You know, because really the whole key is to try to not to, you know, duplicate efforts, I guess, in many things. And even in doing family research, you know, I can't tell you how many people that I have found working for one client where I found somebody doing research on the family and put the two and two together, and now they're sharing costs and archive research and stuff like that. So, you know, that's also part of the game as well.
Absolutely. You can get a lot further ahead if you get more people involved and not duplicating efforts and sharing information. That'll get you a lot further along than if you just try to tackle it by yourself. And that's why we wanted to make this whole experience on Footnote to be a very social connecting means to pull people together, because it's so much harder to do it by yourself.
Absolutely. So in addition to the Holocaust material, you know, any other things that are coming on the horizon with Footnote?
Well, we continue to add more and more documents to the collections that we have. So just because we get to a certain subject and we address it for a time period doesn't mean we leave it and figure it's done. And that goes with the Holocaust as well. But we're continuing to digitize and index more collections as it relates to World War II, this Holocaust being a great addition to that collection, but additional World War II and Civil War records, mainly United States history type of documents, and historical newspapers is a big one that we're focused on. We entered into an agreement with Gannett, which is the largest newspaper publisher in the United States, and we've actually started working on one of their newspapers called the Poughkeepsie Journal, and it is when we complete it, it'll be a complete run of that newspaper, which actually started back in the 1700s. So it'll be a complete run of that newspaper, which is very unique on the Internet with historical newspapers. Usually you'll get a kind of a hit-and-miss time periods of when the newspaper, you know, has been digitized, and this will be a complete run. So we're continuing to add historical newspapers as well. We're adding about 1 million documents to the site every month. And
wow.
So we're at a rapid pace of adding this content, and I would just suggest for people to continue to come back and check it out. You can sign up by registering on the site. It'll give you a means of being able to have us communicate with you on the stuff that we are adding on a regular basis and updates. And so, it's always changing, and there's just more and more great content out there, especially with National Archives. It's like a kid in a candy store, essentially. They have billions of records that need to be digitized and preserved, and so it's just a matter of, you know, taking the time and getting to all that, but we'll be busy for a very long time. It's a great relationship we have with them, and there's just more and more documents that are being added on a daily basis.
And as far as, you know, some of the things that, yeah, I have really found beneficial in my research, obviously, has been, you know, the Texas death records or certificates and stuff like that. You know, are you planning to put any more of that kind of information online?
You know, great question. When you mentioned that we were a history website, we very much are, but you will find information on there that is geared towards vital information about ancestors, and so you'll see a mix of us putting records on that are more from a, you know, a pure historical context basis. The historical newspapers is a good example of that, to, you know, additional Texas birth records or, for instance, Civil War pension files that have never been even microfilmed before. Those actually contain a lot of, you know, genealogically based or focused information. So these widow Civil War pension files that are on paper, we have some scanners that are at the National Archives that are actually doing the paper scanning right now as we speak, and then we'll index those and continue to put those up on our site. But yes, we do continue to add and have a balance of those that are genealogy focused, but also those that are history focused, and sometimes you get a mix of both, and that's, you know, what we're trying to help facilitate. So again, more of those records will be coming out on the site.
You know, going back to the Holocaust collection, it would be really neat. I'm just talking out loud, which I do. It would be really, really neat if, you know, for kids and educational purposes, you know, would be to And I guess it may be something similar to what the U.S. Holocaust Museum does when people enter and they give you a passport with the name of somebody that's, you know, that was a victim of the Holocaust. And when you go through the exhibit, you actually are that person. And, you know, a concept like that for educational purposes, and whether it's the Civil War, you know, or the Holocaust or whatever, is you know, to maybe, you know, drawing people into things, I have found, is very, very difficult, and especially in you know, our formative years when we really have no interest in some of the things that we should have interest in, and then we don't get interested in it until it's way too late to get interested in it, and most of the information that we really need is long gone. But, you know, is to maybe do something fun and, you know, educational, and, you know, draw these, draw kids in a way that, you know, let them be a Revolutionary War soldier for the day.
Yeah, that, I mean, the great idea, and in fact, when we presented this, you know, content to history teachers or even just school teachers, their eyes just get huge because they really are trying to get their students connected with primary sources like this. I haven't been in a classroom for forever, but I was kind of shocked when I went in. There's computers everywhere, and there's an overhead projector in every classroom, and they're looking things up on the web. And I think the teachers really do, knowing that the students kind of, that's the means of how they interact with content, is through the internet, by having this kind of content out there available to them, where they, instead of, say, let's turn to page 325 and learn about Benjamin Franklin, they can actually go to footnote and see the letters he wrote in his own handwriting. And I'm really curious and excited to see how teachers will take this information and use it in their teaching formats and really bring history to life, and so that these kids do develop an interest on a different level than what they've had in the past. But I agree, to create some different applications to make it fun and engaging and interactive is what we're working on. And a lot of fun stuff. And, you know, again, the microsite that we created for the Holocaust was kind of a means of doing that. You'll notice we have a page on there that lists concentration camps, and there's a map that we have on there where you can see where the major concentration camps were located, and clicking on one of those will bring up a page about the concentration camps where there's a photo gallery and a timeline and additional stories and such. So we're trying to make this content a little bit more consumable, a little bit more palatable, where people don't necessarily need to be a hardcore researcher in order to gain the value of this, that they can interact with it on a very high level and get something out of it and get interested in that.
I did not become interested in history or geography or any of these things throughout my school years. And it wasn't until I started doing genealogy where, I mean, I had to get interested. I mean, there are names of places, I've never heard of, and there's still names of places that I've never heard of. And, you know, and two, just understanding my migratory patterns of people and what was going on in even our country. I mean, let's not even look at Europe and Eastern Europe and what was going on in those places during, you know, certain periods of times. But if you look at, you know, their mid-1800s in the United States and how the migratory pattern started, you know, working westward very slowly until the gold rush, which we all know about. But it's that migration, you know, from Virginia and North Carolina through the Tennessee Valley and, you know, over to Kansas and, you know.
Yeah, family historians definitely need to have that that background. The more you can get a contextual understanding of what was going on, whether it's a migratory pattern or it could have been a natural disaster that happened in an area that forced your ancestors to move north, or whatever it might have been, the more you can learn about that information, not only do you get additional information that might help you with your research, but it helps you to get a better understanding of what they went through and where these names, you know, they're on a family tree or on a piece of paper, become people. And there's that emotional connection you have with them. The more you can understand their past and what was going on at the time. And it really does end up being, that's why I think footnote is so valuable to family historians, is because we have both of those. We have the historical events and documents that relate to those events, as well as more of the birth records or a naturalization records as well. So having that mix can give a lot of information and make the whole family history experience a lot more complete and a lot more fulfilling.
And, you know, it is very interesting, too. I mean, now that I have a caseload, working as a professional genealogist, you never know what records are going to basically serve your client the best. And, you know, I had one case where it was newspapers that pretty much told the whole story. Because of the time period, there were no census records to be had. And, you know, all you really had to work with was newspaper articles and then cemetery and death records. But every client, every case, every family history is so very different. There isn't one that I have seen, in my lifetime here that you could even, put two together. And that's the beauty of what we're doing, is we're all unique, although we're all pretty much come from the same source. We're unique. Our families were unique, and how they lived their lives and what they did and how they did it and what secrets we dig up, no matter, what type of record that we happen to get our hands on. The things that footnote is doing is so, incredibly powerful. And, we can't, as genealogists, say that we have to focus on all vital records. That's a major, fallacy. And
yeah,
we have to use everything at our disposal, to get our clues, going. So.
Yep, I totally agree, and that's why we put out records that you might not readily think of, but could have, whether it's the, FBI case files or, some Southern Claims Civil War files, those might not necessarily pop in the forefront of genealogists' minds, but they have proven to be just a treasure trove of genealogical information for people to find about somebody. And it, to your point, everybody's so unique. And there are definitely those obvious places that you can go, birth, marriage, and death records or so forth, but there's so much more information that can be contained in different records. And that's what we're looking at doing with, the National Archives and other libraries and archives, is to try to get as much information out there that hasn't been out there before and see what people can discover.
One of the things that I've noticed, and I guess because I haven't really been doing a lot of caseload work up until a couple months ago, that a lot of the historical archives, state historical archives, are going in and digitizing a lot of their records. And some are more prominent than others, obviously. But these are things that one would never have suspected 20-some-odd years ago.
Yeah, there really is a trend of people that are seeing that these records need to be not only preserved, because the microfilm, of course, isn't going to last forever, but it's, to make it more accessible, too. The problem that the National Archives had was that they didn't have hardly any budget to really do this, and we came in and said, we will not only digitize it, but we'll index it and give you, that information, and we'll do it all for free. And that kind of rang a bell with them that, and there's other companies out there that were doing this, is basically we have the technical know-how and we know how to put it on a website, and then we have the whole digitization process down where we've been doing this for a number of years, that was really helpful for them to have an entity come in and say, we'll take care of all of it for free and we'll do that for you as a free service, and they allow us to put it up on our website. And you're seeing more and more companies that are coming forth. We have archives and libraries that are coming to us all the time that are saying, boy, we really would like to have the same thing for us. And, we're looking at our records and we see that we've got a big challenge here. We need to preserve these documents so they're not lost or thrown away or damaged. And, and our patrons really need to have this information available to them, and we know they can't always come out to our location. So I think this is a trend, Susan, that you're going to continue to see not only grow but become a lot more aggressive in, as technology starts to evolve as well.
Well, I agree with you, and I think I sent you the press release about my new venture, I think, a month ago. Me and a colleague, Joyce Field, are venturing into the data brokerage business because there is a lot of data out there, and some of it's big, some of it's not so big, and some of it's worldwide, and, you know, it needs a place, and, you know, various types of data would be better served in various different types of places, and having been in this field for so many years, that's I want to make sure that some of this data does see the light of day. I think it's so very important.
I agree.
And you know, if we can play a small part in this whole new generation of data collection, I think that I think it's going to be a very fun and, you know, very meaningful situation. I mean, there's enough data out there for, as you well know, you know, I always said many, many years ago is that these projects will take many lifetimes to complete.
Absolutely.
But, you know, the more and more the technology gets better and better and better, and the more and more people loosen up and decide that it is important that their data not be sitting in a stuffy container somewhere in a place that nobody can get to, and, you know, that they understand that this is important and imperative, you know, to preserve history, no matter whose it is. You know, it's I think it's a great field to be in.
It certainly is exciting.
Yep. So, a couple of things on the technological note. Just out of curiosity from my perspective, I guess you have digital systems in NARA full-time, huh?
Yeah, we have, we have some scanners that are in there with the paper documents, but all of the microfilm that we've been scanning, again, to an amount of a million a month, we actually do in-house, and so we have them send us the microfilm rolls, and we put those through our own system of scanners. We have scanners that are going 24/7, and they're digitizing all that content, and then we send that off to some vendors to have them index the information, the pertinent index or pertinent information, so we can create a searchable database off of that content. And then we put it up on our site. We have a lot of servers that are we have about 60 million images on our site right now. And we continue to grow that aggressively, so we got a lot of servers and keeping the website up and running.
I would venture to say, though, the time-consuming part is the indexing.
It is. And that actually, to be honest with you, is the most expensive part of the process as well, to have somebody go through these records and actually type in the names. The DocOwl records are a good example. You have a list of all these names, and rather than just, you know, putting them out there and having people go through them, similar to what you would with a microfilm reader, you know, we're having them type those names in so you can actually search the names in on our site.
You know, that's
very
been done.
Time consuming.
You know, that's been done.
We do. You GenWeb has it, and we've used that as a type of resource to where we can double check to make sure for accuracy. But
okay.
You know, we do want to make sure that we have all of that done. Kind of in our process to make sure we have good quality on those records.
Okay. Just make sure you're not duplicating efforts here.
Oh, yeah. No, we know that the US GenWeb has had the indexes out there for quite some time. So
okay.
It's a very valuable index.
Absolutely. It is. I think that was really one of our first really huge projects we did long before I think there ever was a footnote, and very early on in the life of Ancestry.com as well.
Yes.
It was an interesting project, and I hate to tell you that took us years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, that's just a massive amount of work, just a huge amount of work.
160,000 names, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, just a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. And, you know, while the searchable index has been on Jewish Gen, I guess, for many years now, even though I had access to the digitized images, I don't think I ever really spent the time to look at them, nor would I, nor were they available to look at. And that from a perspective, it's one thing to go and find a name and know that the name is on this list. It's another thing to look at the actual page and to see the name in context with other names and other people, like you said, and here's a person, that was 72 years old, and here's a 12-year-old boy, all on the same page, logged in to one of the biggest concentration camps in the world. So it's a very telling. And I think the other telling tale was the number of pages of people that were recorded as arriving deceased.
Yeah. There's a few records in there that actually documented how much gold was extracted out of the camps, and largely that comes from fillings and such. So meticulous record keeping that just provides some bone chilling details, but it does put it gives you a greater appreciation and seeing those actual documents. You're absolutely right. It's different than just seeing a typed name on a computer screen. To see the actual document is a completely different experience.
It really is. And even early on in my genealogy career, I think the first time I actually saw a relative's name on a census record, it was chilling for me. I mean, it was almost like it was just a really awakening, that's all I can say.
Yeah.
I mean, tombstones and going to visit cemeteries and things like that are one thing. But, looking at a document where somebody has written down somebody's name and details about them that had to be given by them,
mm-hmm.
It's definitely an eye-opener.
Yeah, and it's a means of connecting as well. There's that connection that you tend to make when you see that type of information right in front of you.
It really is. And, I've proclaimed for many years that genealogy and learning about a family history is really a spiritual journey because it is. I mean, there's nothing more powerful, whether it's good stuff or bad stuff, about a family is to really, really look at something, a record, and you really not only are looking at a bunch of handwriting, you are actually looking at a life that existed at a particular point in time that was recorded at that particular point in time. And it was a life just like yours, just like mine, just like our lives are being recorded, piece by piece, and we record our own now on Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different way, but same idea.
Yeah, and it's an incredible document, and especially when you start going back into the late 1800s or even prior to that. I mean, those records are even more fun.
Mm-hmm.
The wills of the early 1800s are incredibly hysterical. I don't think I've read one that hasn't been funny. So, some of the things that were written in those wills are just, amazing when you think of, somebody actually sitting there and writing this down and what they were thinking. And, it's amazing stuff.
Yeah. You'll always make a discovery and it's meant to be fun in some regards.
It is, and I know that those of us who are in the genealogy world, I mean, we get high. I mean, it's an adrenaline rush.
Yeah, it really is.
I mean, And it's a bug. I mean, it is a terrible bug that you get once you get going. And, you know, once you get going, you can't hardly stop. But
yeah.
I got going 27 years ago, and I still haven't been able to stop.
Yeah, we like spreading that disease. That's good for us.
Yep. Good medicine, right?
Yep.
You provide the medicine to keep it going.
Exactly.
It's really, really great. You have other partnerships, I take it, other than NARA?
We do. We have, we've been working with Allen County Public Library, Gannett, which I mentioned a little bit before.
Right.
You know, we've worked with Harris County Public Library in Texas, and we've been working with, you know, some archives and libraries in South Carolina. So, yeah, a variety of different organizations that have provided us with content that we've been putting up there. You know, so we're looking to, you know, we continue to work with people, and hopefully, you know, international will come into the picture down the road, and we'll work with some international entities and everything. So we're excited about, like you said, there's so much content out there. We'll always have something that we'll be working on.
There really is. And I think that, I know over many, many years we struggled, in Europe and Eastern Europe and overseas to get release of some of this, critical information. And I think that as, you know, companies like you and others like you grow and show the value of, having this information online, that I think that there will be a lot of critical information that will finally get released, you know, to the public that will really be essential for really understanding the history of the world as we know it, and as the history of our families, as so many of us have been striving to find out. You know, the genealogists of the future—it's going to be a very different world for them.
I agree. Things are going to be changing quite rapidly as more information comes out.
Now, going back to the newspapers, what is the time frame on that? Because, again, I have found that to be extremely valuable in so many research projects that I've been involved in.
Yeah, our newspapers are basically, they're all U.S.-based. We have one newspaper, the London Times, that we have records on that goes all the way back to the 1700s. But we have newspapers that are fairly recent, in the 2000s, all the way back to the late 1700s. And they basically cover everything from small towns to major newspapers like the Chicago Tribune and so forth. So we have kind of a wide variety. And like I said, with this partnership with Gannett, we're going to continue to add more of that valuable content on the site. So we have a pretty robust historical newspaper and a great viewing experience to see those newspapers and be able to save those and do whatever you want, create pages out of them. So again, it's a very, not only can you find some very fun information in those and valuable information, but you can do just a lot of different things to enhance it and to share it.
You know, one of the things I think the newspaper circa, I guess, 1930 to 1950, 60 is probably a critical piece of major puzzles that if they were being done would be wonderful, because, you know, we lose people in 1930 right now. I mean, we'll see them again in 1940 here in the next couple of years. But from 1930 really till Social Security Death Index came available, we have a glut of very little information.
Yeah, that's. I would agree. There's kind of a big gap there, but we're, you know, with some of the World War II stuff that we've been putting up, you know, and even some of the, you know, Vietnam records that we have out there, and historical newspapers being one of them. We're trying to fill those gaps in the absence of having like a 1940 census out there.
Yeah, because those are big gaps, and that's where people, you know, a lot of people get stuck back in the early 1800s, and then they get stuck again in the 1930 to 1960-65 period of time. And those are the gaps that really need to be filled.
Yes, absolutely.
So I don't know how the newspapers are going to be handled, but getting those done first would really help all of us, I think.
Yeah, we actually have been working on the newspapers kind of in the 40s and 50s and working to fill those gaps. We understand that that's kind of a lot where people will begin their research when they're just getting into family history. So we want to make sure that we can fill that up with as much information as possible to help them along their way.
So, as far as growth is concerned, y'all are moving pretty swiftly. And, you know, the Holocaust collection, I think, is just a really nice piece. So what kind of growth do you expect with that and over the next year or two?
With the, specifically the Holocaust or just
yeah.
overall?
Well, both.
Well, you know, we'll continue to work with the National Archives. You know, we've got a another million or so documents we got to get working on as well, and we'll continue to dive into their Holocaust content and work together with them on the things that they have a need of, as well as the marketplace. And then we just continue to as we get as we continue to grow, hopefully our resources will grow and we'll be able to increase that. But there's no slowing down on the horizon for us. We have so much work to do and so many resources and great partnerships, and the business is doing fantastic, so we're just going to continue to work aggressively. And like I said, there's no slowing down, and I just would encourage people to come back to the site on a periodic basis and see what new things have been added. There will be things that will be unexpected, as well as things you've probably been waiting for, and it's just a matter of getting to all that. But and I think in order for us to even digitize the whole National Archives, it would probably take us about 300 years at the rate that we're going. So there's a lot of work to be done, and we'll continue to just blast through that as much as possible and listen to our customers in the marketplace to see what it is that they want to see up on the site, and work together with the National Archives and other archives and preserving what they need to get done. And there'll be some great discoveries on the site all the time.
And that's true. And I think you even have a means where if there's something of importance that you want to stay in touch with, that you can sign up and an email will be sent to you if something is added that fits within that particular collection that you're interested in following.
Absolutely. It's called our watch button or watch function. And whether it be a single document that you want to watch to see if anybody does anything to it, or a page or a collection, you're able to, by simply just registering on the site for free, you can activate those, and then we'll notify you as soon as anything is added to those documents or those collections.
And then, you know, there is a fee. You got to pay for some of this somehow. But if someone wanted to join Footnote, what's the cost of doing that this day, and mm-hmm. what exactly are the benefits?
Well, good question. It is a membership site, but keep in mind all the social interaction and all the indexed information, which is very different from other sites. All of our indexed information is always free, and the only time you'll be required to pay for or need a paid membership is when you want to see the image itself of one of the documents that we've scanned. That doesn't include what other people have uploaded. That'll always be free as well. But the ones where we've actually taken the cost of digitizing and indexing, we charge a membership fee for, and we try to make that very flexible. So if you wanted to, just for one single image, and that was the only image you want, we have a pay-per-image model for $2.95. You can just download the document, do whatever you want with it. There's a monthly option of $11.95, and it gives you access to all 60 million images. And then for those that need more time, there's an annual membership, and that's for $79.95. It gives you access to, again, everything that is current on the site, all 60 million images, but will be for all the images that we add throughout the course of that year, which will amount to be more than 12 million more images that you'll have access to. So those are the different membership options, and we wanted to keep the cost as low as we can and make it flexible for people so they can get in and utilize these tools. And the benefit of that is, you know, for the cost of even a monthly or even an annual is far less than what you would have to pay if you were to, order a copy from the National Archives or even travel to the National Archives, where is basically what you would have to have done before Footnote came along. And the process of just being able to sit in your own home and not need to go anywhere and just access this from your computer is a huge benefit for many people that don't have the financial or even physical means of being able to travel to these different locations to look at these records.
I'm going to tell you, 27 years later after I started, I think probably one of the biggest benefits of any membership like this is not to have to use one of those microfilm copy machines ever again.
Yeah, those big bulky things are starting to become dinosaurs.
Oh, my goodness. I was back at Clayton Genealogical Library a couple weeks ago, and oh, my God, I said, I hate this.
Number one,
I hate going through these films. And
it's intense.
Number two,
yep, it takes a lot of hard work to use those, and hopefully we're making that a little bit easier by letting you just search.
Well, you know, they even have one that you can actually save to one of those flashcards.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I hadn't been in so long, I didn't know they had that. But in any event, I happened to have my computer with me that had a little portable hard drive on it, and I was able to get that to work, but nobody knew how that was going to work. But it's still bulky, and you still have to take that reel, and you still have to put it on that machine, and it's still
yep.
backwards from the way it was somewhere else. So, if you've been down that road before, this is quite a pleasure.
Yes, it makes things quite a bit easier.
Justin, I thank you for being back. I thank Footnote for getting involved in the Holocaust-related data. I think that is an important venture. Jewish Gen has Holocaust-related data because it really relates to us. But to really make sure that this data is available to the general public and in ways that I think are, like you said, interactive and in ways that can better educate all of us to the atrocities that did happen back in World War II, I think is so very important to preserve history and to preserve our planet. So my thanks and my hats off to y'all for doing that.
Well, thank you very much. We feel it's important as well, and we'll continue to keep you updated on what we're doing.
All right. We would appreciate it. In any event, it's Susan King, and this has been Where Genealogy and Spirit Connect. You can find me at www.susaneking.com. And yes, I am doing caseloads for people who are interested in having their family history started, so give me a holler if you're interested in that. Next week is going to be a surprise for me, too. We'll see you then.